We appreciate your generosity. Each year for a week, we host Fundrive, our annual fundraising campaign that boosts our budget and supports our operations. Thank you for your support.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. A few weeks ago, I promised you that there would be some surprises this month. We have been working now for over a year on a brand new long-form series. It's called The Newfoundlander, and it's by award-winning journalist Justin Brake. And I got to tell you, I find myself at a bit of a loss as to how to introduce this story and set it up for you. It's the kind of story that I think is best left alone to just sort of tell itself. What I will say is that it's a big decision to invest in a story and put a year of work from a lot of different people into bringing it to life. And the reasons why I decided to do that with this story, well, I think that they're the same reasons why a lot of people would have passed on this one. I mean, this is a story that just does not fit into any recognizable genre. This is a story that every time I felt like I knew where the story was going and what kind of a story it was, it kind of surprised me and became a different kind of story entirely. It's also the kind of story that is so incredibly specific, but also has implications for thousands and thousands of people. It will likely upset a lot of those people, but it contains truths that really have not been shared anywhere else. And I guess more than anything, it's the kind of story where I just had to know how it all ended. It's the kind of story that I just don't think would be told anywhere else but by Canada Land. So today is chapter one, and we will be releasing subsequent chapters of The Newfoundlander each week. Let's listen to The Newfoundlander. Wait for it.
I'm at a production of the hit Broadway musical Come From Away, only not on Broadway, but in Montreal, where my mother and father-in-law live. It's 2019, and they're treating my partner and I to an evening out. We're seated, waiting for the lights to dim and the curtains to rise. Welcome to the Rock! I'm excited. The play is about my hometown, Gander, Newfoundland, and its people, and their response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks when thousands of passengers were diverted there. The people of Gander turned schools into makeshift accommodations and rallied to provide their stranded and terrified visitors with food, clothing, and shelter. Then, partway through the play, a scene that will change my life. An elderly man, hunched over, and slowly walks across the stage and sits down face to face with a rabbi, one of the people who has come from away to find temporary refuge in Newfoundland.
There's a man here in town. He's lived here almost his entire life. When he heard that there was a rabbi diverted here, he came to find me to tell me his story.
I was born in Poland, I think, and my parents, they were Jews. They sent me here before the war started. I still remember some prayers they taught me. As a boy, I was told I should never tell anyone I was Jewish, even my wife. But after what happened on Tuesday, so many stories gone just like that. I needed to tell someone.
It's a powerful scene. A rabbi finds himself face to face with a Holocaust survivor in hiding, a survivor who chooses this moment to reveal himself. That man, he's my grandfather. Pop, who I knew very well, who I'd fished and trapped with, who let me drive a quad for the first time when I was 8, whose jubilant smile and laughter are ingrained in my memories of him, memories I've cherished since he died in 2008. My grandfather, who I thought had hailed from a long line of breaks from the Bay of Islands on Newfoundland's west coast, not from Poland and not a Holocaust survivor. If it's true that my grandfather was Polish and Jewish, well, that would contradict everything I grew up believing about who my family is and where we come from. I'm a Newfoundlander. I was born in Gander 42 years ago, 2 days before Christmas. My father joined the Mounties and they moved us around. First to Oshawa, Ontario, then Saskatchewan, then Ottawa. As a child, I intuitively knew Newfoundland was home and that we simply lived away. Like everyone else on both sides of my family, I was a Newfoundlander. I never questioned that. Gander was an airport before it was a town. The Newfoundland Airport opened in 1938, on the eve of World War II, back before Newfoundland was a part of Canada, when it was still a British dominion. It was one of the world's largest airports, strategically placed on the shortest route between London and New York, where Canadian, British, and American military aircraft could refuel before crossing the Atlantic Ocean. That's how Gander came to be known as the crossroads of the world. Over the years, the airport serviced commercial aircrafts heading overseas, but as technology evolved, the traffic tapered off. Then, in 2001, 9/11 put Gander back on the map.
This just in, that is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Thousands of stranded passengers. Their planes were diverted here after the attacks. A quarter of those passengers are in Newfoundland. The province is a little overwhelmed.
Residents turned their homes, churches, and schools into makeshift accommodations for 7,000 stranded travelers. They shared everything they could. Food, linens, clothing. My family took people in, cooked for them, shared stories, built friendships. The town's response to 9/11 made headlines, an example of the light that can shine through even when the darkness engulfs us. Besides giving rise to a Broadway musical, Gander's response to 9/11 also inspired a movie and a book called The Day the World Came to Town. The musical Come From Away is inspired by it, and it's in that book where my grandfather's story first appeared, the story that he hid his true identity from me and from everyone else in his family for his whole life, until revealing it to a visiting rabbi. I need answers to the questions about where my family comes from, because if I don't know that, I don't feel like I can have the knowledge to understand who I am and what it is that I'm supposed to pass on to my children. And there's one obvious person to start with, the rabbi. The rabbi's name is Levi Sudak. I learned that he's been telling the story of his encounter with my grandfather for years. Here he is in 2020, speaking to an audience in England about my pop, Edward Brake, and revealing new details that can't be found in the book or the play.
Ed asked me, please, take your finger and run it down the back of my head. And I could feel indents in the skull where he'd been thwacked. The war came. Business in England was tough. It seemed that there was a business opportunity in Newfoundland. And Ed's parents, new parents, migrated to Newfoundland.
I can't believe what I'm hearing. Before Pop died, when he was in palliative care, I did try to ask him about his past. He changed the subject, and I dropped it. But Rabbi Sudak, he had a whole bunch of stuff I'd never heard. So I emailed him. And he called me right away.
So, the story begins in Berlin in the 1930s when the Nazis came to power. Your great-grandparents lived in the city and were recognized as Jews. And the young Nazis would come around to the Jewish homes every evening and pick up one or two of the children and march them off to the local school and bring them into the gymnasium. Now, the floor of the gymnasium, your grandfather said, had a pug floor. I gather that's cork. And the children were made to take off their shoes and their socks. On the wall around the gymnasium, there were nails banged into the wall at around shoulder height. And these Nazis would tie strings to the big toes of the children and make them crawl up with their feet up the wall so that just their shoulders and their necks were resting on the floor, and would tie those toes of these poor little children to the nails. And the children would lie like this for a long time. If they flinched, a searing pain would shoot through their body.
Rabbi Sudak tells me that Pop showed him evidence of this when they met. He took off his shoe and showed him his foot. The rabbi says my Pop's big toe was indeed disfigured, that it sprung out from his foot to the side like an extended thumb.
There came a point where Jewish children would be allowed to leave Germany, and that was what was later became known as the Kindertransport. However, your great-grandparents paid a fortune of money that your grandfather and his brother should be adopted by an English family. That's where the name Brake comes from. Your grandfather did not remember his Hebrew name, and he did not remember his birth family name. And the reason for this was that the Brakes would beat both children senseless, and your grandfather asked me to be a witness and to run my finger down the back of his skull, and I could feel the indents. And he said, those indents are from being thwacked with a pole on the back of my head. Any time that we were caught singing a Jewish song or saying anything that sounded like Jewish, they would get thwacked like that on the back of their head. There came a time when the parents, now the adopted parents of Ed and his brother, decided to move to Newfoundland. And the treatment continued the same way.
The treatment continued when they arrived in Newfoundland. What did you mean by that?
The beatings.
By their British adoptive parents?
Adoptive parents, yes.
Tortured as a child by Nazis for being Jewish? And then beaten by my great-grandparents for acting Jewish and for singing Jewish songs? This is all new information to me, but a piece of it hits hard with the force of truth. The abuse. The beatings. I did know about that. And there's another piece I recognize. Back around the time I finished high school, around 1999, my grandparents and all seven of their children happened to be in Gander at the same time for the first time in years. They gathered in my aunt's backyard for just their second family portrait ever. It wasn't until that photo was developed and enlarged that we noticed on the knob of the walking stick my pop was holding was a Star of David. I vaguely remember some remarks within the family about my pop using a walking stick with a symbol of Judaism, a religion we knew little about and certainly had no connection to in our very Catholic family.
And I saw the cane, beautiful work of wood, and in the knob was carved out very beautifully a Star of David. Your grandfather didn't tell anybody what was special about the cane, and evidently either your father or your uncle or someone exclaimed to your grandfather, Dad, you cannot have that. They're going to find us and they're going to kill us. So this was evidently a fear that was in the hearts of your family members, that Nazis could still raise the ugly heads and
do terrible things once again, which is probably why the story is not told a lot in your family.
The rabbi's story is gripping, but I just cannot believe what I'm hearing. If this is all true, then it wasn't just my grandfather who kept secrets. My entire family was in on it, suppressing the truth from the world and from me out of a fear of Nazis emerging in Newfoundland. I had intended to just listen on this call more than speak, but I can't hold it back. And I find myself telling Rabbi Sudak that this just doesn't make sense to me. I tell him that I still believe my pop was born in Newfoundland and that I need to keep digging to get to the truth of all this and then reconnect with him to sort it all out. But that was the last time we spoke. He'd agreed to talk to me again, but hasn't responded to my messages ever since. But he did keep sharing my pop's story. Only now, I was in it.
I have been in touch with Ed's grandson. He was very surprised by much of what he had learned through the play and then from me about his grandfather. As far as he was concerned, his grandfather was never in Europe.
This is from an interview Rabbi Sudak did with the Canadian Jewish News for the 20th anniversary of 9/11. He's speaking to their host, Ellen Besner.
But as far as Mr. Brake's family goes, I think I read that you provided him with a talis and some other Jewish religious artifacts and hoped that he would take them and use them to be buried with them. And was that ever done? Do you know? Because he died in 2008.
Sudak explains that when a couple from Gander visited him in London in 2005, he sent back with them some things from my pop.
And I sent with them also a talis and a siddur for Ed. Ed made a party when he received his Jewish gifts. Ed was very proud to have his Jewish gifts. Ed, when he passed away, asked that these gifts be buried with him in his coffin. And that, I know, was carried out.
I have the yarmulke and prayer shawl that Rabbi Sudak sent my pop, so I know they were not buried with him. And I was at the funeral and his wake. I saw his body in his coffin, and I did not see a prayer book in there with him. Combing through my memories of Pop's funeral is painful. It dredges up a memory of the night I learned that he had died. And this part isn't easy for me to share. My father's name is Edward Brake. My middle name is Edward. That name goes back generations in our family. You might be wondering what my father has to say about all this. The thing is, we're estranged, and it has nothing to do with my grandfather. But I will share one anecdote with you. In October 2008, after I'd moved home to Newfoundland, I was in Ottawa visiting my folks for Thanksgiving. The book containing my grandfather's claim to Jewish ancestry, The Day the World Came to Town, had been published already, years earlier in 2002, and my whole family was still trying to come to terms with it. My father didn't believe the Holocaust survivor story, and like most in our family, he didn't really discuss it much. But I wanted to. On that night at my father's place, we talked about Pop, and I mentioned that I was still thinking about the Holocaust survivor story, that part of me thought it might be true. Our conversation quickly turned into a heated argument, and I went to bed upset. When I woke up in the morning, I walked out of the spare room and into the kitchen. My father was already up, holding his coffee with a concerned look on his face. "Justin," he said, "Pop passed away last night." I paused for a moment, then broke down. "We killed him," I yelled, wiping tears from my face. "We killed him." Somehow, I thought the previous night's argument had reached my pop, and in his fragile state, it was the nail in his coffin. The only person I really feel comfortable speaking about all this with is my godmother, my aunt, Anne Marie, the person I'm closest to on my father's side of the family. She had a special bond with Pop and knew him the best. She took care of him right up to the day he died. It's October 2022, and the vast, hilly landscape around Gander Lake looks like one of those realist paintings of a perfect fall scene with bright yellows, oranges, and reds.
I try to be out here because I find it's a nice place to just meditate and, you know, just think and kind of, I don't know. I feel close to Mom and Dad out here. And I feel
Anne Marie and I are sitting on a cemetery bench next to my grandparents' graves in Gander. She remembers the moment in 2003 when she first picked up a copy of the book, The Day the World Came to Town. It was written by American journalist Jim DeFede.
So I went to a book stand and found it and found the pages. And I was like, oh my heavens, I can't believe this. Oh my. And I just didn't know what to think.
It felt like everyone in Gander had read the book.
When people read the story, they would approach you and they would tell you, oh my goodness, Anne Marie, I read the book. I read your father's story. Oh my goodness, I'd love to chat with him about it. And they would just be going on and on and on. So I didn't have to say a word. So I didn't confirm or deny. Because I was still processing it myself and I didn't know how to react to it. But I remember this one person in particular. I went to school with this woman and we were good friends. And we were in a retail outlet, and she came up to me and she said, Anne Marie, I read about your dad. And I just kind of nodded my head. And because I only nodded my head and I didn't respond, she grabbed my arm and she squeezed it really tight. She said, you don't believe him. You're one of the ones that don't believe him. You should be ashamed of yourself. And she proceeded to call me out on it and tell me off. So I still never said anything. I just let her go on. And you know, eventually it was over. And, you know, that conversation was very uncomfortable, to say the least.
Before we go on, I should tell you who I always understood my grandfather to be before the book and the play complicated and challenged all of it. Poppy, or Pop as we say here in Newfoundland, was born and raised in Cornerbrook, on the banks of an estuary where the Humber River empties into a fjord in the Bay of Islands on Newfoundland's west coast. He had brothers and sisters, some of whom I met as a kid. His father died when he was just 7 years old, and his mother remarried. My grandmother, or Nan, was the daughter of a lighthouse keeper from the Northern Peninsula. She and my pop met in Cornerbrook, got married, and started their family there. In 1961, they moved to the bustling new town of Gander, a few hours away. Pop took a job as a salesman at Eaton's department store. He was so good at dealing with people and selling stuff that he later opened his own appliance and furniture warehouse. Whenever we'd go home, he'd take us to his cabin, out fishing in the summer, snaring rabbits in the winter. He didn't handle stress well, and I recall a few of his arguments with family members. He shouted sometimes, but he never hit. He also never directed anger at me or any of his grandchildren. I always felt safe and loved with him. He was also diabetic. When I was with him, he'd wince and gasp as he poked his finger to draw blood. Then he'd look up and chuckle when he saw the concern on my face. He taught me to chop and saw wood the old-fashioned way, with a buck saw and an axe. He was in his element in the woods, calm, happy, at peace. But was he? If all that time he was hiding a secret about who he really was and everything he had endured, because he was terrified that it could all happen again. Well, if that was the case, then my whole understanding of him is a lie. If I can't speak again to Rabbi Sudak, I figure I might learn more from the people who made my grandfather famous. Irene Sankoff and David Hine, the married writing duo who created Come From Away, a huge hit that scored them nominations for both a Tony and a Grammy Award. According to their website, they're now writing a screenplay to turn Come From Away into a movie. What do they know about my grandfather's origins that I don't?
Your grandfather was very, very popular. Everyone told us about him. And now I'm hearing about the turbulence in the story, and I'm like, oh my goodness, that must have been hard. But such respect.
And by the 10th anniversary, when we traveled out there, obviously he had passed by then, and we were sad that we couldn't meet him. But everyone knew the story, and so many people told us the story that we could tell that it meant a lot to a lot of people, that there was this connection and this rediscovery of identity and who you were. I think the feeling that came out for us as storytellers in this time when everyone was telling us the stories was how important our stories are and how our identities are tied, are interwoven with the stories that we tell. And so that's why on stage, Eddie, the character of Eddie, says there were so many stories that were lost that day. I needed to tell someone. And so that was important, both to honor the storytellers who were sharing so generously with us their experiences, but also to commemorate all the stories that had been lost.
Irene and David are playwrights, not journalists. They got their information about my grandfather from author Jim Defeaty, the reporter who wrote the book The Day the World Came to Town. But Jim Defeaty won't give me an interview. He does tell me in an email, though, that my pop corroborated the story that Rabbi Sudak had shared with him. He always viewed himself as Jewish, and according to my notes, he felt it was time to tell his story and that he'd been bottling it up inside for too long, he told me. There's one other person with first-hand knowledge of all this, a man named Dave Shaw. He was my grandfather's friend, and also the man who approached Rabbi Sudak about this in the first place. As far as I know, he was the only person my pop shared the Holocaust survivor story with before the rabbi heard it. But like Jim Defeaty and the rabbi, Shaw does not want to do an interview. He said he'll only communicate by email and that he doesn't, quote, want the exposure. He says he asked my pop's permission to share the story with the rabbi, but he also says he wasn't present when Sudak met my grandfather. Last fall, Anne Marie came to visit me and my family on Newfoundland's west coast. I took them down to Brakes Point, named for my family, and the very spot where, as far as we knew, my pop was born and raised. We sat in my car and I played my interview with the rabbi for them.
Oh God, it's wild. That's the first time I've heard the story. A lot of it is true, but not that way.
And here is where I finally got somewhere closer to the truth.
Like when he described the, what was he called, a pug floor, and that meant the dirt floor.
The pug floor. The rabbi thought it was the floor of a Berlin gymnasium in which Nazis tortured Jewish children. He thought pug must have meant cork. But this was a dirt floor of a home in Newfoundland. Anne Marie has seen this place and knows it very well.
Like you come down around the house, and it's not a basement because it's not dug down. It's a floor, but it's a dirt floor. Mm-hmm. And it was just like wooden.
A dirt floor my family never would have seen had it not been for my pop's father becoming ill. My pop was so young when he lost his father. And it's a well-known secret in my family that after my great-grandfather died, Pop's stepfather began abusing him and his siblings.
He was abusive to everyone in the family, and I think to my grandmother as well, when I look back on it. It is known throughout the family that he beat the boys terribly. And they probably had broken bones, and maybe it was never attended to properly. I was under the understanding that he didn't beat Dad as badly because Dad was quick to go and he knew how to make a dollar.
And there are details of my pop's Holocaust story that bear a striking resemblance to accounts of his childhood in Cornerbrook. But the part about Nazi torture, that part's hard to talk about. Anne Marie remembers the place where the abuse happened.
You come out what I consider the front door of the house, and it was almost like a little path coming down around the house. And as you're coming down around the side of the house, it's like the bottom of a deck today. It was painted brown, and then you walk around the front, and there was a little door in there, and the door was on these hinges that were almost like a V shape. You know, and they had big tack-type nails, I guess, in them, and it was like the size of the top of my thumb. And the latch on the door, and then on the inside, not anybody was allowed in there. And I know that because I was in there as a child, up higher where I couldn't reach. There was just like a little piece of wood like that with a nail in the middle. It was nailed on one side so you could turn it back and forth. And it was like a handmade latch. And that was put there for a reason too, so if there's any children in there, they didn't go out. Mm. The smell was like wood. Everything was dark. But there must have been some sort of a light, like maybe a flashlight or something.